Hey guys, this is Hunter Levine, and thank you for listening to the Captain's Collective Podcast, brought to you by Skinny Water Culture, All Hands Vodka, Costa Sunglasses, Turtlebox Audio, and Orvis Fly Fishing. Recently, some friends and I got the chance to spend a few days fishing around Chandelier Islands, remotely located on the easternmost point of Louisiana. During our trip, we stayed in a floating fish camp called the Pelican Chandelier, and spent our days chasing bull reds, jacks, and other flats fish, and spent our nights eating great food, smoking cigars, and enjoying drinks on the camp's rooftop. We carved out a little time to sit down with the Pelican's owner and operator, Richard Schmidt, to hear his story and the history of the Pelican, and how he likes to approach these big fish. In this podcast, Richard shares about their fishing and operations, what he's learned from taking on the Pelican. And during our rapid-fire questions, Vince DeGura and Chase Hancock from Skinny Water Culture hop in and help pick Richard's brain and hear about his passion for boxing, shark stories, and so on. To learn more about the Pelican Chandelier and to book your spot for next year, head to the blog post at captainscollective.com. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoy. This is the Captain's Collective.
I'll say it's anything you choose, I think it picks you. You know, it's genetic.
Let everything else stop in the world and just be quiet. And it's amazing where your mind goes at that point and where it doesn't go. And sometimes just that quiet space is what we need, and especially in this day and age.
If you have a fly rod in your hand, it's this tool that takes you to beautiful places. You meet hopefully wonderful people, and it's just this cherry on top of this outdoor adventure.
When the fish is coming, that shot within a shot, that timer start. Beep, 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 beep,
beep, beep, beep. No one else knew anything anyway, and you just definitely making it up as you're going along. But
so what Grandpa and Dad would tell me is like, all right, where's the old big trout laying out there? Where's his shaving cream on the water? Where's he been shaving this morning? So look for his shaving cream on the water, and that's where he's going to be.
All right. Well, hey, Richard, thanks first off for having us to this beautiful setup you have here in Chandelier Islands. And thanks for making some time this morning before we go and fish to sit down, tell me your story, tell me about your operation here. And man, it's been nothing but first class.
Thank you, man. It's so good to have you guys on board, Hunter. It's been fun so far.
Yeah. So tell me about the history of this place before we even dive into you. Tell me about kind of the Pelican Chandelier and the history and what you're trying to move it towards today.
Wow. Yeah. So there was a guy named Mark Stebley who's had this place forever, and it's been a special place for everyone who's ever visited Chandelier. It's been a refuge for people in their boats during storms. They can come and be safe. And literally everybody that I know on the Mississippi Gulf Coast has come and at least spent a night here, you know. And I believe he started it in around 1983. And it was just a little barge he built by hand, all by himself, and it's expanded into what it is today. However, it has been destroyed a few times by hurricanes.
Yeah.
that's just part of the gig.
Yeah, absolutely. So 1983 starts as a little barge, mostly trout trips. And
yes, it's trout trips. He had four or five Carolina skiffs, and they had run out, And gosh, back in the day, I mean, everybody likes to talk about back in the day, mm-hmm. The trout fishing was just ridiculous. You could blindfold yourself and just run the skiff, shut it off, and blind cast and catch all the trout you wanted.
Wow.
So it's, you know, those days are still available, but just not every day like the old days.
Back then, was it still eight people? Has it expanded in its capacity to hold anglers?
Well, I'm not 100% sure. We have a different marketing strategy than he had. Mm-hmm. We're trying to keep it at 8 to 9, 10 people max, mm-hmm. Just because it makes it a more comfortable environment.
Yeah.
I think he had I stayed on several just overnight trips is what he called them. And it was very inexpensive. But the logistics of this place, it's like I need to have eight people come out, stay for 3 nights because it takes it's a production to get all the stuff out here, you know,
definitely.
And the fuel and the employees and the food and the fuel.
Yeah.
So it's always worth it, you know.
So for those listening, give them a run through of what they would expect if they were doing. Are all your trips mostly 3-4 day trips?
Every trip we have is 3 nights and 4 days.
Okay.
So you'll show up at the dock in Ocean Springs Harbor. We'll load up your gear around 11:30 if possible, and into a 32-foot twin V catamaran boat. And it's a pretty comfortable ride. And run you out here. We provide your ice, water, some of the best food you'll ever have for, accommodations. AC generator. We're going to provide you with a skiff with push poles, so you can pull around, look for redfish, or just drift the trout beds and catch trout. It's a it's a magical place. But I'd like to go through what your day would look like. So
yeah.
You're going to arrive, and generally everyone is so excited to get here. We throw the bags in the room. And everyone jumps in a skiff and they just haul butt. We have lunch prepared and it's like, okay, guys. And the guys will come back eventually, when they get hungry. So they'll fish that first afternoon. And when they come in, we have hors d'oeuvres and steaks already on the grill ready for you to for dinner. And there's a cocktail. I call it the cocktail lounge, sky bar, on top where you can hang out and have a cocktail and watch the sunset. And it's just some of the most beautiful sunsets ever. And we'll wake up early in the morning. My crew, Jason Cox and Eli Troutman, and sometimes myself, are up at 4:30 in the morning making coffee and breakfast and making sure you have plenty to go and, plenty of fuel to go with, to take with you to go out and for a full day of fishing.
Yeah.
And when you come in, we'll have lunch ready. And, a lot of people take naps in the heat of the day and go back out for the evening bite and come back in. So.
Yeah, it was awesome last night to... One of the cool things about kind of how we're doing this trip, all eight of us are, we all either knew each other or knew of each other. And so everybody goes out in their skiffs and running all over the place. And, some of the guys didn't even want to stop here on the way in. They just, as soon as they got to the island, they just started fishing. And, but it's fun because, as there's smoke on the grill coming up and you're sitting at the sky bar and you're talking to your friends, recapping the day, showing photos. I mean, that's real. It definitely not only pulls you away from, the normal rhythms of life, but it also just, it's so relaxing. And you don't have cell phone service. You do have Wi-Fi here.
Yeah.
But, all day you're just out there and you're just wondering. You're like, we were getting on the radio and we didn't hear anything. And we were like, I guess everybody else is on fish. We all got back and pretty much that's what happened,
That's true. That's one thing I wanted to mention too. It's a do-it-yourself operation. We're gonna send you, or we're gonna give you an idea where the fish are. And if you're struggling really hard, we'll get in the boat and go with you. But it's not that hard, as you can tell. We had 4 skiffs out yesterday, and everyone caught personal best redfish on fly, multiple times over.
Yeah.
So it was, it's definitely a doable trip. And also you get some satisfaction when you go out and find fish on your own, and you just, it feels so much better, like, hey, I did this. I used my guts and what I know about reading water and fish and made it happen on a rod that's made to catch a brook trout in a stream,
You're
pulling in 30 pound fish.
Yeah. Very visual too. I mean, you can see them here. It's not like you're just blind casting into, you can very visual fishery. And you were talking about the sky bar. So you have the sky bar, you got bunk rooms, you got, give them the run through of the layout and everything of the actual, cause this is a really special place. I'm sure to some people they might miss just how unique it is, but give everybody the run through of kind of what the setup is here.
Yeah, absolutely. So we have 3 barges, moored together. And they're about 48 by 60 feet long. And the first one is the galley and the crew shower quarters and the generator room. The next barge moored has a little screen porch on it, and it's just a bunkhouse. And this is a fishing lodge. It's not, I would like to make it fancy, but it is what it is.
It was air conditioned last night.
It's air conditioned. And it was ice cold. I had to bring my sleeping bag.
Yeah.
It's definitely it's a lodge. And you're going to be sleeping with 8 guys that some of them may snore. But we have CPAP available, electricity for that and distilled water. But the next barge is the crew barge, and we have a screen porch that we're sitting in right now doing this podcast. And, you know, eventually we're going to convert this into an actual, you know, nice hangout instead of just a screen barge and the crew quarters. And above us is the Sky Lounge and some of the best sunsets and sunrises and just, fellowship with your friends happens up there.
Yeah.
It's amazing. Like you said, whenever we were recapping our day, you know, there's nobody staring at their phones. Everyone is engaged in conversation and just, it's reminded me of the old times.
Yeah. I mean, it definitely feels like you're either going back in time or you're going to a different planet, you know?
Absolutely. We have a guy that comes here a couple times a year named Kyle Kennedy, and he says that he made a shirt and he called it like the Pelican on the Moon or something like that, because you're so disconnected from society when you're out here, and yeah, you're just in wild, you're in nature,
and you can choose with the Wi-Fi. I like it too, because a lot of us have kids, you know, you can choose if you engage and who you engage with, you know, so basically everybody is fun too, you know. People are kind of coming in and they're calling their families and FaceTime in, so that's it's absolutely a great setup. Tell me a little bit about you. Where do you and the story of the Pelican intersect?
Well, of course, Mark Stebley was a legend. Everyone knew him, and he was actually my neighbor growing up, kind of. And I had an opportunity to come work for him back in like 1996 or so. And I would run trips for him, like run people out every now and then. I'd get to stay tonight and fish. You know, that was part of the gig, he would call it.
And yeah,
you know, you run these guys out, I'll let you spend the night and you get to fish all day. And I did that for him for a while. And, you know, life gets in the way. I got married, had kids. And staying out here to work was not going to be an option with a family.
Yeah.
Now my family is basically grown. For the most part, and the opportunity came available. Mark said, "Hey, man, I'm thinking about selling the Pelican." I was like, "Are you kidding me?" I said, "This place is magical." And he's like, "But I only want to sell it to someone who's going to treat it the way I would." And so, back in January of, I guess, 2000, we made a deal and shook on it, and I hope I'm doing him proud.
Yeah, I mean, I it's hard to. It's hard to imagine a place like this going in the hands of somebody who would take something you built, literally built by hand, and you literally poured your blood, sweat, and tears into, and then, you know, hard to imagine it going to somebody who wouldn't honor that. So I'm sure that felt to you pretty meaningful to get that
torch. It absolutely was, man. It really was. And you know, not only did he build it by hand once, he built it three times because it got destroyed in three hurricanes or two hurricanes.
Wow.
So, but yeah, it's pretty special, and I feel honored. And we're not trying to reinvent the wheel here. The things that are important to me are conservation. Mm-hmm. I'm hoping that we can be a gateway to the chandeliers for conservation. I'm hoping we can start promoting more catch and release. We're talking about doing a catch, photograph, and release tournament where at the end of the year, whoever catches and releases the biggest trout and the biggest redfish, you know, maybe gets $1,000 off the trip next year. So, or they get to come for free.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
You know, and I think that's a pretty good, you know, that's a pretty good incentive to release a nice fish.
Mm-hmm.
Let that baby grow, because this is obviously my livelihood. I need people to come out here and catch fish, but there has to be fish to catch. But for me, honestly, catching fish is not my priority. When I get out here, I melt, I relax. I just turn into a piece of jelly. It's so relaxing. I've seen you.
Yeah.
Relaxing.
It's an easy thing to do here. No hard task here with that, you know. Back at home with kids and traffic and things like that, I think people struggle a little bit more.
Yeah.
So, did you grow up fishing here as a kid?
I sure did. It was gosh, I would get out of school at 3 o'clock in the afternoon and jump in my dad's 19-foot Aqua Sport and haul butt, knowing I only had an hour to fish before it got too dark. And I would fish, because I'm just eating up with it, and then jump in the boat at dusk and run home. And
how old were you at the time, you think?
Oh, gosh. You know, old enough for him to let me use the boat, so probably 15.
It's a pretty far place for most 15-year-olds to run.
Yes, that's the crazy thing. I don't know that people understand. We're 26 miles offshore, and it can get pretty treacherous. Mm-hmm. If you've ever been in the Gulf, you know how choppy the water gets, and there's not big, huge groundswells that you get to see in the Atlantic where you can kind of dodge it. The waves come, and they come, and they come, and they come, and you think that you're never going to get here. And you're in the middle of the ocean, and you can't see land behind you, and you can't see land in front of you. And you feel kind of small.
Yeah. Did you ever have any stories over the years of running out here where you thought, I'm going down with the ship? Have you gone down with the ship?
I have not gone down with the ship. I've taken several waves over the bow. And the only time I think I was felt like I was in trouble, and I never wanted to tell my dad this, so I hope he's not listening, was in his aqua sport.
Yeah.
I think we almost sunk that thing a few times. But,
wow.
Man, my little Hell's Bay, I shouldn't feel so comfortable taking the waves over the bow as I do.
Yeah.
But it's not a place where you want to come out in a 18-foot skiff and do this on the reg, you know. And that's the beauty of the place. We have this 32-foot twin V that's going to get you out here in anything, and you're going to roll up to our dock, and we're going to have 5 poling skiffs waiting for you.
Yep.
And I think it's the best way to experience the chandeliers, especially for a sight fisherman.
Yeah. So tell me about you're a kid, you're coming down here, you're fishing your dad's aqua sport. At one point you get the opportunity to work for
Mark Stebley. Yes.
So at one point you get the opportunity to work for Mark, and then kind of for you, did you begin guiding shortly after that? Did you go into a regular career?
Well,
what did that
I
path look
started
like?
As a marine biologist. Fun job. Oh my gosh. So much fun. But it still wasn't my passion, you know? So I got my captain's license, and I started like an apprenticeship underneath another guy. And, you know, flats fishing, I didn't know that's how I was going to evolve. I knew I wanted to work on the water. Mm-hmm. And, this guy named Bo Hamilton he worked for another man that had several boats, and Bo would let me operate sometimes and mostly clean the boats. And eventually, when I could afford my own boat, I started guiding around Ocean Springs, and just part time, you know, just to get my feet wet and see if I could do it. But, you know, family is there, and you know, the number one thing in my life was family. You know, mm-hmm. So a fishing guide is, and most of these captains that you've interviewed can tell you that you're gone before the sun comes up, and you don't get home until the sun comes down, and then you're beat from being in the sun. So it kind of came down to a point where, you know, at the time my wife had a 2-year-old. She's like, you can either be a fishing guide or you can be a husband. It's like, I think I'll be a daddy.
Yeah.
You know? So I went back.
What did you do in that season?
I sold insurance, which is a very lucrative career, but it's never fulfilled my passion. You know, I sat behind a desk getting yelled at by people, and I had to wear shoes, of all things. I mean,
yeah.
You know, it's a pretty big leap of faith to leave a secure income,
sure,
and take on quite a huge debt
when, yeah,
buying this place. But you know, I'm following my dream finally after 51 years.
Yeah.
You know.
So tell me about the leap of faith, because I think that's something that when I interview people and they talk about making and most of the time it's in the context of, I quit my job and became a full-time guide, but I still lived in the city. I still, you know, had for you this, and then in a lot of them, when they become full-time guides, they don't take on large debts buying a big business.
Right.
So tell me about, what did it look like for you to work through that? And was that an easy leap to take? And
no, I'm still processing it, because let me back up a little bit. I owned a fly shop from...
I just keep digging out gold here.
From 1999 until 2005. And that kind of jump-started my guiding career. Still part-time guiding. And this was really before the internet. So somehow I got hooked up with the Department of Tourism for Mississippi. And he brought in Mark Sosin, and we did several fly fishing shows. And he brought in this guy named Chad Foster from Fly Fishing America, and we did TV shows with him. And from every different network, from TNT, we, you know, and every time we did a show, the phone would just start ringing. So I stayed, you know, I kept my weekends booked, and booked and booked and booked. And then I think that was the point around 2005 or so. And my wife was like, you know, hey, I decided, you know, I knew it was taking a toll on being a dad.
Yeah.
Then the fly shop is a great way to make a small fortune. I mean, you start out with this large fortune, and after 5 years, you just have a small fortune left, if anything. It's a tough business. I don't know how people do it.
With kind of looking back at your life and those different shifts, and then the most recent shift of kind of coming into this, what advice would you give people who are wanting to do some sort of go from insurance to guiding or owning a shop, lodge, whatever? What advice would you give them?
Oh my gosh, man, just think about the amount of work you put into the job that you hate. Could you imagine putting in that same amount of work for something that you love and you're passionate about? I mean, you're going to do it tenfold, you know, twice the effort, 10 times the effort that I know I'm putting in, 10 times the effort that I did in insurance to this place and to my guiding career. Because, you know, I absolutely love it. And I think one of the biggest things for me is sharing this place with people who've never seen it before, and sharing the Mississippi Gulf Coast with people who've never seen it before. They're like, this is Mississippi. This is crazy. I've heard all kind of crazy stuff about it. You know, the water's, you know, it's brown, but until you get to the islands, it's pretty water. You know, we have sight fishing. We have, we have great entertainment. It's, there's a lot of history in Mississippi, and it's worth visiting for sure. And I would love to take you fishing if you come.
So tell me about, for you, like, you're growing up out here in, you know, grew up in Mississippi. You got a 19-foot aquasport when you're really getting into it. You're getting the bug. But where does fly fishing for you come in? Because I know something that you're hoping to see more of here is that people would come and they would fly fish and see this fishery as not just a trout fishery, but a red fishery that's accessible for people and able to come out and have great days.
Yeah, absolutely, man. I think it's... you know, I picked up my first fly rod, just like most people. My dad had one sitting in his closet, and I took it outside and just started playing with it. I was like, man, this is kind of fun, you know, and he kind of showed me what to do, and that was about it. And, you know, when you fish a lot, or if you do anything a lot, and it's not a challenge anymore for me to come out and catch fish on a spinning rod or a bait caster, it's like, okay, I've done that. I can catch my limits. And then I said, okay, you know, now I just want to catch trout that are over, you know, 25 inches. You know, that's what I want. So I progressed to just trying to catch big fish. And then I said, okay, now I just want to catch trout on topwater. I'm like, all right, now I'm pretty good at that. Now, what's next? And so let me try this on my dad's old fly rod. And I was like, oh, this is where it's at.
Was it an 8-weight or 9-weight? I mean,
it was an old Fenwick fiberglass. There's no telling. Had the little, you press the button and it sucks the line back up, you know. But, you know, and that was challenging because I fished with that for a little while, didn't catch a fish, and I went into just a shop, and this guy named Steve Loper said, hey man, you ought to, you know, this is a good reel rod, go out and try this. And we went out. And he's one of the guys that got me into wanting to own a fly shop. He sold me the gear and then took me out fishing, and we caught fish.
Wow.
So, and then I was like, this is it. I have arrived. This is fun. I can do the same progression now, and there's different species, you know. I mean, gosh.
Do you remember your first redfish on fly?
I do. It was in the Horn Island Lagoon. I was waiting, and I was blind casting my butt off. I knew I had the right fly. I knew I was in the right spot, and I just really did not know what I was doing, you know. And boom, it finally happened, and I'll never forget it. It was a fly they call the Chandelier Special, of all things, and all it is a clouser that's tied with green and red flakes. I definitely remember that fly. And that day, and I have a couple of those flies in my box we're going to try out today.
Awesome. Did you, when you caught your first fish on fly, did you know instantly that that was going to become a big part of your life? Or was that something that you just kind of dabbled in and out of before you really got sick for it?
I never picked up a casting rod again. Yeah. So that was it. I had arrived. I was like, okay, this is it. This is fun. And I was by myself. I had nobody to share the moment with. I was just, woo!
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so it was a special, special thing.
Wow. I definitely love hearing people's kind of first fish stories and how those things often shape them in the long run. When you look back at everything in your life, that from the insurance to owning a fly shop to, you know, getting some of the opportunities to work here early on, what do you feel like were some of the big lessons that you learned that helped you become a better angler and better, essentially, guide?
Oh, wow. Yeah. Trust your gut. Oh, my gosh. Man, my gut. I mean, there's a natural serotonin in your stomach that's when you know when something feels right, then your gut lets you know. Mm-hmm. And, of course, you know, the same old things you know about red fishing points, pockets, and, you know, shallow water to help you see them and things like that. And I think that, I hate to even say this, but dealing with people in the insurance, because nobody's happy in insurance. You know, hurricane blows away your home. You know, the first person they're going to yell at is me.
Yeah.
But having the patience to deal with folks that can't really cast, and you show them 100, you know, 120 fish, and we don't catch any. I still have the patience, because nobody wants this person to catch a fish worse than I do.
Yeah.
But not to chastise them, but to help them learn, you mm-hmm. know, and make it a teachable moment. Like, hey, okay, let's try this time. Mm-hmm. Well, that didn't work. Let's try this time. All right, maybe the sport's not for you.
Yeah.
No, I promise you, I'm a fly fishing evangelist. I mean, if I want everyone to do it, I want everyone to be successful. And I've had people that, you know, I had a couple last week that fished with me, and we, same thing. They broke off two bull redfish over 30 pounds, and it would have been their first redfish. Could you imagine their first redfish story? I mean,
yeah.
So I'm kind of glad it broke
might
off.
Might have ruined them, yeah. When you went out as a kid with Steve Looper, he took you out, he kind of showed you, that was your kind of crash course.
Right.
What did that look like, and do you kind of, did that shape the way that you take people out and try to teach them?
Absolutely. I mean, he spent more time showing me how to cast and how to strip and how to, you know, get the fish on the reel than you know. And so it is. And he doesn't even know this. I haven't seen him in probably 20 years. But yeah, he was a big influence on the way I guide people and talk to them about fly fishing, you know, patience.
Yeah. How has your guiding changed since you've been out here?
Oh man. You know, my guiding is, I don't get to fish out here enough when I'm guiding because of the logistics. Mm-hmm. I mean, to make that 25-mile crossing in my skiff, and I have someone from Birmingham or Wisconsin or St. Louis, you know, they're just not water people, so it's a little intimidating for them to get out in 3-foot seas. So I have to fish the barrier islands and the marshes. But if we have a day like today, I guarantee we're coming out and we're going to get here in a hurry. It's slick, guys. I wish you guys could see it. It's like butter.
Oh yeah. I'm sure the guys are tearing them up right now.
I'm so jealous.
Yeah. We'll be out there soon enough. One of the things I want to circle back on too was just, we talked a lot about the actual physical place of the Pelican Chandelier, but can you kind of give people a rundown of what the lay of the land looks like fishery wise here? Because, you know, you got some interesting stuff going on with vegetation, to how the flats lay. Give them a little rundown of that.
Absolutely. And the islands are, it is about 15 miles long to the south tip, from the north tip to the south tip, and it runs north and south. On the west side of the island are mangroves and marsh and shallow flats that extend about a mile out. I mean, you can just about wade a mile from the marsh and mangroves to the first sandbar, and a lot of my trout guys love to do that. And the grass clears the water up, so it's crystal clear. You can see very well. And personally, you know, I like to pull those flats and look for big bulls floating over the grass, and they glow. The trout guys like to throw their topwater baits and over those grass, and the big trout explode on them. And there's bayous that run through these mangroves that you can pull the skiff through and go catch redfish. There's a few cuts in the island, and a lot of water flowing through there. And so there's always fish where we find moving water. On the east side of the island, it's all hard bottom sand. You can barefoot wade it. And there's generally big trout out there if you're a trout guy. Always redfish. So if you can never fish the outside, you got to get out there and catch redfish. There's schools, the little slots. Unfortunately, the smallest fish we saw yesterday was 30 inches.
We were all okay with it, but yeah.
Yeah. We need to catch something for dinner, so somebody needs to catch a slot fish today.
Yeah. My bet's on Chase Hancock.
Yes, I like that guy. He's a good caster, too. So, yeah, there's that. The outside beach has two sandbars, and it's really clear water in places, and it's all... one of my favorite things to do is grab a backpack, stick a Yeti jug full of cold water in there and maybe a celebratory beer, and walk down the beach with a box of flies and in my pocket and fly rod in the other hand, and just, if I walk 2 hours and catch one fish, it's pretty special, Yeah. It's a good time. The solitude and just the one-on-one, you and the fish, just enjoying the moment,
When you think about what you hope this place will become and what you hope to see here,
oh yeah,
what comes to mind?
So, I'm not going to try to reinvent the wheel. Stebley has made a good thing happen for a long time. However, I told you about following your passion. Well, my passion is fly fishing. So the more fly fishers I can get out here and show them, how incredible it is, the more enjoyable my job is going to be. Also, I tend to see that the fly fishermen are more conservation minded. And yesterday we didn't keep one fish. The trout guys that come, they kill a lot of fish. And it's a paradox. I mean, I need these guys to catch fish so they come back, but I don't want them to kill all these fish because we need them to catch for the next group, you know? The truth be told, these guys get to fish once a year, so they come out and they catch as many as they can, and I hope they get to eat them.
Yeah.
So we definitely cook a good portion of them for them on the third, the third night, so
yeah,
they can.
I'm looking forward to that for sure.
Yes.
Yeah. That's going to be fun. But yeah, I mean, me and you were sitting out at the dock this morning and we were just talking about, how special this place could be too for, a lot of guys who fly fish. There's all these stereotypes and stigmas, and the truth is there is bad elitism in the fly fishing community. But if people remove how being a fly fisherman makes them feel in comparison to other people, if you just talk about the actual experience, it's always about experience, right? Like, why do you fly fish? For the experience. Why would you come here? For the experience. So I think like groups of people similar to what Vince put together from Skinny Water Culture with this is, I think you'll see groups of people say, man, I just want to hang out with my 8 friends and fly fish, and everything from breakfast and coffee, watching the sunrise and having drinks from the Sky Lounge, to everything's about the experience and not necessarily about what do you take home. It's actually just, even if you take nothing home, you just, the experience here is really what it's
absolutely
all about,
man. That's what I'm selling. I'm selling the dream. I'm selling an experience. And, as passionate as I am about fly fishing, when I get out here, I rarely fish. I'm fishing today because I'm with some fishy guys and it's just fun to have some people that are, like-minded and just want to go out and catch fish and can pull a skiff, number one. Yeah. I don't.
A lot of us like pulling and watching somebody else. It's a different little challenge. You're higher up, so you can see more. You got a cooler perspective a lot of times on the eats. I mean,
yeah, it is. That's another thing too. I live in Mississippi. There's maybe two pulling skiffs, so I have two buddies that can fish, but their kids play baseball and whatever and tennis and. So I have nobody to pull me, so I'm pretty excited about you guys being here.
Yeah.
My other best friend, Barrett, from Lafayette, has to drive all the way over to come pull me.
You're going to be getting a bunch of emails from young kids. Yeah. I'll pull you, Mr. Richmond.
Yeah. As soon as they pull, and they do it, they're like Tom Sawyer and Huck Finn. They start pulling me in circles immediately. So I'm like, hey, just get off of there and let me do this, okay?
Yeah, especially on the beach. Watch the breakers. Watch the breakers. Yeah,
and then we're swamped.
Yeah. I'm excited about the next bit. I want to do some rapid fire questions if that's okay with you, but I think we'll do it tonight at the Sky Bar, Sky Lounge, with have some of the fellows around doing drinks, and let's go fish.
Man. Yeah, let's do that, man. Cool. I'm looking forward to you polling me around some.
All right, so we got everybody here. We're having some drinks, coffee.
Wait, were we recording that the whole time?
Yeah, we were.
Oh, sweet.
Nice.
Bailey's creamy.
That's some good content there.
And some creamy Bailey's.
That's good stuff. But time to transition to some rapid-fire questions out here on the porch. So our first question is, and I should say this, I got Vince DeGura and Chase Hancock on the mic, and then the rest of the guys are hanging around.
We're all here.
Setting the scene. There's a rainbow.
There is a rainbow.
Could you describe the rainbow, Vince?
It was different colors. Goes up and arcs, comes down, off in the distance.
That was
amazing.
Best description of a rainbow I've ever heard. Yeah. Powerful, powerful
stuff.
If
I was blind, I could see it so vividly.
All right, Richard, question number one. What is the sketchiest moment you've been in out here?
Oh, my gosh, man. I think it's the freaking sharks. They scare me. I don't like those things at all. So I had a ladyfish on my fly, and I wanted to see if the redfish would come around, so I let her panic a little bit and see if it would attract some fish, and all it did was attract the sharks, and she got sharked immediately. And then all the sharks came, and I'm knee deep in the water, and all these little baby sharks are running around my feet, and I'm like, this is not about to be good. And so I had a client with me, and he started high stepping to the boat like, you know, Deion Sanders just scoring a touchdown. And I was like, oh, if he's sketched, you know, maybe I should be scared. And next thing I know, I look down, there's like 15 or 20 little, you know, 2 foot long lemon sharks, and one of them chews on my little toe. And so I look like Billy White Shoes Johnson. I don't know if you guys remember him. That's kind of before your time, Vince.
Yep. Vince was all in the sharks yesterday.
There was a lot of sharks.
He was the shark man.
Yeah
for sure.
So, yeah, definitely the sketchiest thing for me is the sharks. I hate sharks, and there's just so many. So,
what's the wildest moment you've had as far as catching a fish, like a fish eat or a situation?
Gosh, man, I don't know. There's so many. The wildest thing I think I've ever seen is I had this huge jack on, you know, it's probably 160 pounds. And,
world record.
Yeah, world record for sure. It was
all
going.
Tackle.
Exactly. And I was in this fly fishing for jack tournament. And so I was pretty excited about it. It's going to be a nice big jack. And the size of the shark that came and ate the jack, just his stomach. Like, he bit the jack, and the only thing left was his mouth and his tail. And it was amazing. That was pretty wild to see.
What type of shark was it, do you know?
Oh, I'm sure it was a bull shark. It was huge. Yeah. The biggest sharks I've seen out here have been bulls and hammerheads. God, hammerheads are stupid big out here.
Wild.
So the word on the street is that you used to be a world-class boxer. Tell us about that.
It's not used to be. I am.
You're never a has-been boxer.
Right. So
you can always land one.
Here's the deal. I didn't start boxing until I was almost 40. So I decided I really liked it. I had a bunch of mouthy friends growing up, so I had to fight all the time because they couldn't fight, but they could run their mouth. Mm-hmm. And
Like Vince.
That's just like me.
So I love it. And
the mouthy part.
Yeah. Not a fighter. So anyway, I started doing some.
Not a good fighter either.
Not a good fighter. So yeah, I entered some tough man contests in college, and I was like, oh, this is kind of fun. And then, you know, years and family went by, and then I started training, you know, not professionally, but training. And it turns out that there's not in Mississippi anybody my age that you can actually box. They're all kids, you know, and it kind of hurts fighting those kids. They're faster and stronger and not as pretty, but. So anyway, I started going to New York to fight once a year and train with some professional trainers, and it's really fun. I do it every February, try to get in the best shape I can, and go up there, and they actually have people, like, they have to be my same age. You know, I'm 52 right now, so I have to fight somebody between 57 and 40, whatever, 7, and they have to be within 10 pounds of my weight, which when I get down to my fighting weight, I'm at 142 pounds, which is stupid skinny. It's almost as skinny as PJ Johansson. So, but yeah, it's a fun time. It's just nothing makes you feel more alive than getting hit in the face or punching somebody in the face. And it's the legal way to do it. And it actually, you know, it doesn't hurt. You know, once you've been hit in the face, if you've ever been in a fight, it doesn't really hurt until the next day. So it's fun.
Has that changed? Like, have you learned any lessons from that you feel like you've applied here?
Yes, duck. Whenever somebody's tossing their fly behind you and you're on the platform, you got to duck. And you got to be good at ducking, especially when Vince is up there and he has no presence of, you know, spatial presence of where he is and what he's doing.
Oh, he knows. He's trying to catch a fish. So he doesn't care.
That's right.
You move.
So, Richard had a moment yesterday, but we won't talk about it on air.
I can't remember that.
Casting moment.
Oh, yeah. I hooked myself in the ass twice. It's because the guy was screaming at me. It got me all...
To be fair, you didn't hook me, though.
Yeah, because I used to like you.
Oh. You can control the fly like that. So. Yes.
I was mad at myself.
So what's one piece of gear you have to have on the boat with you that's not a fishing rod or fly?
Oh, man, that's interesting. Besides sunglasses. Or raincoats.
Man, beer?
Oh, if you don't have beer, then we can't fish. We can't even be friends. I pulled up next to this guy in his skiff the other day, Bryson. Hey, man, toss me a beer. And he throws me this thing. And it's like some kind of spiked seltzer tropical punch. And I'm like, that's not a beer, dude. Unless you're drinking...
Was it all hands?
If you're drinking all hands, you may come on the boat and fish. but whatever that stuff is he tossed me is not beer and not considered an all hands. So.
Rimmick sent a huge case of all hands that lasted 4 hours.
Yeah.
I heard it was good. Yeah. Thanks for sharing, guys.
The problem with all hands is... They taste like a delicious treat.
Yeah.
But so you drink two, and then you have to sober up for the next 4 hours.
Yeah. They pack a punch like Richard.
Yes.
Fighting another 52-year-old man in New York.
Maybe they can, that's going to be the next logo. Maybe they'll sponsor me. How about that?
You should be on a can.
Oh, yeah. Heck, yeah.
Powerful stuff.
Very powerful.
When you get a chance to fish with all these different anglers over the years and have people come through, in your opinion, what are some things that make a great angler?
Gosh, the eyes are my favorite. If someone can see fish before I see them, I get so excited and pumped up about that. I think even you yesterday were like, you cannot see that fish? Like, no, dude, I'm 52. You're only like 15. I mean, I can't see. So that's my favorite thing is somebody with eyes and you know, unfortunately, we don't get a whole lot of great anglers, so we're blessed to have you guys on board, and it's fun to watch you guys fish, man. It's just insane, the casting and the way you guys can see and the hook sets and especially the way you land fish, Hunter. I mean, you've only broken off like two of my personal best this weekend, so.
Who fishes 20-pound tippet, dude? What normal people. What do you mean, the Bahamas?
Yeah. Getting there. But yeah, just somebody that can actually throw a backhand cast and see fish is awesome.
I like fishing with people who can't see, because then whenever I cast at a fish and they didn't see the fish, I'm like, oh, perfect presentation.
Can I scratch all of that and retract that statement and say the most important thing I like about someone is that they can pole a skiff? And you're getting there.
I'm getting there. I was in the surf. I have a question for Vince. Yesterday we went out crabbing with Richard and he took us to this top secret crab spot.
Crab X.
It was my spot.
He found
crab
it.
X.
He's been scouting it since he's been here.
On Google Earth and kind of looking at the contour of the ground and everything. Give us some tips on crabbing. Richard, you can chime in too, but Vince, could you give us just some crabbing tips based off your experience?
Doing it the way we were doing it, you just got to go hard on it. You can't let the crab get away. So you just got to. We were just dip netting them. You know, it's like ankle deep water, a little bit more than that, but they're going to get away from you. And if they get away from you, they're going to bite you. So they're not bite you, but claw you. So
yeah, they're mean.
They
get mad if you try to catch them. So
small nets, smaller net the better. More skill is like fly fishing for crabs. Anybody can go out there with a big net and catch crabs.
Yeah. Well, the
Vince
thing,
is using a bait net.
Well, Vince has got good eyes. He's spotting these crabs from 100 yards away.
Yeah,
I mean, he's like two crabs 100 yards up here.
two crabs, 2 o'clock.
We developed a two-person system, too, where they were trying to run deep, but then we'd have a, basically, we would, it's like dog hunting, you know? We would just basically push them to each other and scoop them up. And I think overall we got some great crabbing content. Richard was caddying the
skiff there.
He wasn't doing much.
he had the turtle box on it and the and was monitoring the beers and
yes, and keeping the sharks away from you guys. By the way, you're welcome.
You put me in the water with the sharks.
I know.
You're like, hey, we want to get you a fish since Hunter's already caught him today. Hunter, stay on the bow. Vince, get out there with the sharks.
So, and you were doing something you call marinating.
Yes. Oh yeah, that was
which
awesome.
Is when you just lay in
just
the water,
just float in the water and drink a cold beer. So it's you know, the way I think of your intake and you know, you're putting in some fresh spring water and hops into your body, mm-hmm. and then releasing the toxins in the salt water.
It's important.
Very important.
It's the circle of life.
So give us a full talk through of your perfect day out here. If you could write your own perfect day from the little details, give us that, including a nice marinade session.
See, that's it. Now you nailed it with that, man. My perfect day is waking up to pancakes that Jason Cox just cooked for us and bacon and clear blue skies, light west wind, so we can, you know, fish wherever we want. You know, getting out late. I don't, you know, that's the greatest thing about fly fishing is you get to sleep in, you know, rolling around the outside beach around 9:30 or 10 and just seeing singles, bulls after a single bull floating in, you know, 2 foot of water, backs out, coming down the bank. Then at noon coming in and we got big lunch served at the Pelican and possibly a nap after that, a few cold beers. And then heading out and doing it all over again, but just in a different spot, you know, look at something different, something new. And then after that, you know, the sun gets low around 3 o'clock, we just sit on the north tip, float, drink beer, talk about the good times we had, throw high fives, catch crabs.
That was fun.
That was yesterday.
It was definitely a great day.
So cooking wise, you guys have a lot of great food here. What are some tips you have for cooking fish based off all the fish you guys cook up here?
Gosh, man, I have some of the best chefs on the island and probably, you know, on the Mississippi coast that actually work for me. So it's I can't give you any tips. You would have to talk to Todd and Jason and Jason's dad, Ty. These guys, they're the best cooks ever. And if you guys will actually catch some fish that small enough for us to eat, you'll find out how good it is.
It's been a real problem.
I caught one.
Did you bring one back?
We have
one. Yeah, they got one yesterday.
They got one slot.
We caught one fish under 30 inches yesterday.
Yeah.
The redfish are gigantic.
I haven't even seen a redfish under 30 inches. And this is...
I'll splice in a little recipe in this from him.
Okay.
If he's willing to
get it. Yeah, he is.
He seems like he might be a vault on information.
He is, and he's the vault. But he will tell you a little bit about how he does his redfish on the half shell, which is not rocket surgery, but his is the best.
Okay.
And he has a couple secrets that he
Hunter
does.
Hunter does that.
Yeah,
does
we do redfish on the half shell, and then we just kind of drizzle it with some Mike's Hot Honey.
Yeah, that shrimp sauce piquant we had last night was really good that Vince missed out on.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
I can afford to miss a meal or two.
If you could only fish one fly the rest of your life, what would it be?
Oh, dude. You know, we have a fly, a buddy of mine, ties, and it's basically, he calls it a deep minnow. It's a Clouser minnow, whatever. And it's olive with red flakes, you know, red flashy blue or crystal flash. I don't know what that stuff's called. I don't tie into flies to know. And it's he calls it the chandelier special. And I would fish that on every different size that you could make it, you know. Mm-hmm. The bigger the better for these bulls and the small one. Everything eats it, and it the color pattern, he patterned it off of the old traditional Cockahoe minnow that was that motor oil color, the green with the red fleck.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a staple here, and you know, I don't think people use that one quite as much as they used to.
That's one thing we got to do next time we come out is get a fly tying station set up.
For sure.
There's
yeah.
plenty of time like now that we could be tying some flies.
Yeah.
Came pretty unprepared with some... you know, I'm from Jacksonville, so my redfish average 18 to a good redfish is upper slot 27. Over 27 is a really good red up there. And so we have small little flies. I tied 12 flies to come here, and like two were big enough. So I'm already out and like digging through people's bags at night when they go to bed.
God, we have broken some rods this weekend too.
We're up to three.
Three
rods. I was just about to ask, what's the worst like gear breakage situation you've had, like from skiffs to, because it's tough out here because you're 26 miles off or whatever, and
yeah, we've stuff breaks. Sunk so many skiffs, it's crazy.
You've sunk a bunch of skiffs.
Yeah, and the sandbars are pretty treacherous, and if a storm picked, the last one we sunk, a storm picked up and the guy was running down the beach, turned east to come to the Pelican, hit the sandbar and couldn't get the motor trimmed back up, and the waves overtook the boat, and they're standing on the sandbar, knee-deep water, ankle-deep water. And, we tracked them down, got them, left the boat there overnight, and it flipped and sank. And we've had a couple of them sink over here against the Pelican in big seas. You know, we got a hard west wind. But that's the ones that hurt. You know, heck, I can replace a $1,000 fly rod, but these skiffs, you know, the fiberglass doesn't get hurt, but the engines, and just trying to get the engine back to the boat guy, and then, you know how it is getting parts these days. And, even getting a new engine, like, hey, I can get you one next summer. No. Got a trip coming up in 2 days. Come on. It's tough.
With all the different things that you've had to learn running this place, what was the hardest thing for you to, or what do you feel like you still don't maybe have your mind fully wrapped around?
I'm just not a good manager. Like I said, I'm a good people person and salesman, but the money part of it and just managing employees and getting a good schedule going and things like that, you know, just details. I'm a left brain kind of guy, or right, I don't know the difference, but I'm not the detail guy, you know. Luckily I have a good detail guy, Evan, in my corner, who stays on my ass, and like, because he has to, because I'm really terrible at it, you know. I'm like, hey man, but look at the sales. Like, yeah, but you suck.
So you guys have a lot of different skiffs here. I think there's like actually 10 boats tied up right now.
Right.
And I know that you're really into skiffs. And just talk to me a little bit about kind of the different types of skiffs that you use out here, and then why you use a Marquesa personally.
Oh, you're talking about the skiffs that we brought. The Marquesa for me is just, it's an amazing boat. It can get out here in some nasty, nasty stuff, and it still floats plenty shallow, you know, to get to anywhere we need to go. But I'm not saying I haven't pushed this boat off the bottom 100 times just this weekend. But but it's you have to have something that's going to be pretty bad to handle the seas and still float shallow, because this whole place is nasty shallow. You know,
It was great on the beach.
Yes, the beach is so stable.
I was really glad we had the bigger skiffs for being on the beach. I mean, that would be a totally different scenario, the smaller skiffs.
Right. We have small poling skiffs at the Pelican for our clients to use, but we do not encourage them to take them to the other side, because I think Vince told me yesterday he passed somebody that was bailing their skiff out from one of the other mother ships because it got beached and washed up on the shore. That was Chase, one of these guys.
Yeah, that was Chase. Yeah.
It was one of the guys with the SWC hat on. I can't remember which one. They look a lot. They look so much alike.
We're almost twins.
Yeah.
They look exactly the same. My beard's smaller, but that's it. Really.
Y'all got anything? Any questions?
Done a great job, Hunter. I'm just trying to think. I'm still gathering.
Are we going to be able to fish today, you think?
Survey says yes.
Looking forward to it.
Yeah, we developed a new technique for crabbing yesterday. I think it's going to go viral. Whenever you put Vince on the casting platform and pull the skiff, actually looking for the crabs, and then he has to do like a gainer off of the bow with the net and still catch the crab when he orients himself from the ground, and it's.
It was amazing to watch. I have it on video.
It almost seemed like it was unnecessary, because when I got out, when I landed, the crab was still there, and I hadn't gotten him yet.
Yeah.
And then I got him.
So. But you catch him by surprise.
The whole jump part almost, I mean,
I think it shocks
I don't
want to
give away the secret, but like the whole jump part was really just showmanship.
Yeah. Right. Well, it stuns them. They're like, they're in awe, and they can't move.
They've never seen that before in their whole life.
That's likely. You're
and a lot of people who are crabbing, you know, they might say, do I really need an $80,000 skiff?
Yeah, but
and the answer is
yeah.
Do you want to catch crabs?
Yeah. Just be careful. It's slippery underneath where the crabs were stacked on top of each other. It's kind of slippery.
Vince
broke my tailbone.
Vince broke his tailbone on his skiff. So.
Yo. Dan's been looking at us like an idiot for like 30 minutes.
That's his only look.
Dan's like, why are we not fishing right now?
Yeah. I've never seen anybody fish as hard as Dan. I'm excited. I hope I get to fish with him today.
Oh, I hope you do too.
You should be able to.
I hope he gets to chase. I hope Dan he gets to pull me.
Dan's got some questions.
Does Dan have questions? No. All right, I'm just going to wrap it up there.
Yeah,
then.
Cool.
Just hop back down, Chase. You're throwing the vibe off now.
Sorry, I wanted Dan to get in here.
All right.
Dan's way more interesting than me.
How come you are you going to interview Dan ever?
If Dan will let me.
He won't. Probably won't.
I thought this was the trip because I thought at some point Dan would get lit enough to let me interview him, but that's not it.
Oh, we'll get. He'll come around.
Eventually. I would like to interject. There is an awesome group of guys here on this trip, man. Yeah. Some fishy individuals and just fun to hang around and you know, we generally like to show people some of our spots if they're struggling, but we haven't had to do that. These guys have found fish on their own.
Whoa. There's spots we don't know about.
Yeah.
We're
going today.
This is struggling. We need to get out there.
What Richard doesn't know is the first night we snuck on his skiff and got all the coordinates off his GPS.
Right. Yeah.
But we didn't. We wanted him to be proud of us, so we didn't tell
that's
him.
That's right.
But. Well, hey, Richard, thanks so much for coming on the podcast, and we really appreciate it, man, having an awesome time.
Hey, Hunter, great fishing with you, and I appreciate the opportunity, bro.
Thanks again for listening to the Captain's Collective Podcast. Help us out by sharing this podcast with your friends online and leaving us a review on iTunes or Spotify. Thanks for listening. This is the Captain's Collective.
Anglers search for the one they call king, but who will take his throne? Tune in to Waypoint TV's Battle for Silver, Saturday, May 18th from 12 to 6 p.m. Eastern, presented by Abyss Battery. Waypoint TV.
So while it's fun to go like just full-blown redneck on these fish. This is like high-tech cane pole fishing right here.
From the white sandy beaches to the crystal blue waters, enjoy the best fishing Panama City Beach has to offer during Chasing the Sun. Sundays at 9:30 a.m. Eastern on Waypoint TV, the destination for outdoor entertainment.